Hi, everybody. Welcome back to The Gods Will Not Save You, The Wire Revisited. I'm Willie.
Hi there. My name's Jakob, and this is a podcast where we do a deep read into each and every episode of the show The Wire.
That's right. Anybody who wants to donate, as always, you can do so at anchor.fm/thegodswillnotsaveyou/support. Let's just get right into it, and let's talk about Season 4, Episode 10, Misgivings.
Yeah, so pretty painful opening here.
literally.
Yeah, with Walker and Donut crossing paths while Donut's joyriding in another stolen car.
Yeah.
Sees Walker and doesn't end well for Donut, so...
Yeah.
Let's just, I don't know what you want to talk about.
Crazy little chase pursues with lots of cars being damaged and Officer Walker verbally assaulting a woman for needing bifocals or something.
Oh, yeah.
He crashes into a woman's car and tries to pass the blame off onto her.
Yeah, but he does kind of own that situation where
a little bit
of humanity from him where he's like, okay, deep breath, I'm really sorry.
Yeah,
I hate this kid and I
want to go break his fingers.
Yeah.
Donut almost gets away with this little scheme thing that he's got going on by switching out his wardrobe with another hopper. But eventually Walker catches up to him and breaks his finger. It's pretty brutal little scene we got there of a cop assaulting a child, which brings me to a little bit of an interesting point. It's kind of a thorny, controversial topic that we had brought up before. David Simon was talking about, all right, let me just read you.
Yeah. Just
the quote that I read on Alan Sepinwall's blog, great writer for Rolling Stone magazine, but he did a whole blog series talking about every episode of The Wire. He's been a great resource for us to kind of do our deep dives. But he had asked David Simon at one point if Officer Walker was deliberately conceived as a black character. And Jakob, I know you mentioned this before, that there were some talk about how David Simon had theories about how maybe black cops were more particularly brutal. You know, it's a little bit of a problematic, delicate thing that we're discussing here. I just want to read the quote that he gave to Alan Sepinwall in the interview, and I feel like he kind of puts the argument out there rather articulately. So Walker was conceived as black because, tellingly, when Ed and I were on the corner in West Baltimore, we noted that many of the more brutal, more shady patrolmen were actually black. Why is this so? Hard to say, but perhaps a mercenary or brutal patrolman is camouflaged in some sense if he is African American. A white officer engaging in predatory practices in the ghetto would be subject to all kind of racial us-against-them stereotypes and stigmas. With a black officer behaving so, the racial politics are rendered moot. And from the perspective of some black cops, many of whom have working class roots and who have reached their newfound authority by having to eschew the temptations of the street and keep to a moral code, there is often, I have found, a contempt for the black underclass that some white cops would not dare exhibit. It's perhaps easier for a black cop, having reached his station in life, to heap contempt on those who have not done so, saying to himself, I did it, why the hell can't they? White cops, as outsiders, may not be subject to the same self-conscious judgments. Walker is more a function of class consciousness than race consciousness. I get a sense that people who still think police brutality is linked to racism rather than classism are about 10 years behind the street. Now...
yeah, Daniel Herschel has entered the chat.
So this is... I feel like this is kind of like a mostly like a brilliant argument that he's putting forth about why there might be some animosity toward, like, some, you know, self-loathing or something within the Black community of Black people who choose to be cops. But I think there definitely is like a racial component to police brutality.
Yeah, I think so. 100%, I think we could say that.
Like, and I don't know if David Simon still feels that way, like after the widespread use of cell phones and, you know, stuff like that, where people are able to film, like the horrible disparity in the way like white suspects are treated by police as opposed to Black suspects. It's pretty clear cut nowadays, I'd say. I mean, like, yeah, all his arguments about, you know, this being a class thing are very valid, but to say that police brutality isn't linked to racism might be a little outdated.
Yeah, and I don't know. I don't really know what he would say these days, though, honestly, because you know how the whole argument is, well, this has always been happening. It's just now it's being filmed. But who better to have had access to what was actually happening back in the day before cell phone video cameras than an actual police reporter who was embedded in the police department on the streets of Baltimore writing books about the coroner? I mean, he's definitely seen a whole lot, I believe, that we probably don't even know about and we'll never know about with, like, white cops. And
yeah.
David Simon's just always playing KRS-One, black cop, as he rides around West Baltimore.
Yeah. But that's a pretty, you know, controversial topic that I felt like we had to get into, and now it's making me really uncomfortable.
Yeah, so. Yeah, I'm glad you put on sunscreen. It's not, like, highlighting here. Yeah, but hey, I mean, this is, yeah, thanks for sharing. I'm glad that we kind of put that to rest. Or, I mean, it's very clear cut and makes me feel like I'll sleep a little better not thinking back on what I said many episodes ago. Like, this is what David Simon always talked about, his plan to show that the Black cops are the worst and they just are, like, self-hating and they're just going to make an example of everyone who makes them look bad. And this and that.
Yeah, really uncomfortable subject to talk about.
Yeah, I mean, not probably one of his best takes, in my opinion. But hey,
I mean,
I do understand the, you know, like, that's intersectionality, right? Like class and race and all that stuff. But is it mostly just staying along one racial boundary? I can understand some of it, you know, there's Johnnies, there's white junkies and unemployed whites, and they get mistreated too on occasion, blah, blah, blah. Willie's getting nervous. He's like, why is Jakob not perspiring a bit? He seems, I'm just like, yeah, let's just keep going. Cancel me. Yeah, so let's just jump into education because they're turning up the heat to make kids drowsy, just like the like the temperature in this room just went up.
No. I have it set at 78 degrees. I don't know why I'm fucking sweating like a
78. No, that's good. I mean, but we could go back to politics. I was just like, I just saw like making be more heat as a note.
80 degrees.
So Clay de fucking facto Davis is talking with old Burrell. They're scheming up some stuff. Help me understand exactly what the hell is going on in this episode.
Well, Clay Davis and Nerys Campbell are against the idea of having Daniels be promoted to police commissioner. So they're trying to get Burrell to do some quote unquote police shit to make himself seem more valuable in Carchetti's eyes, which makes him bring the hammer down and be like, we got to do more arrests for loitering, you know, public intoxication. We got to juke the stats to show that like we're on top of it. But Clay is like, man, the level of like scams that he's running, like playing both sides is so, scam likely, just like the cell phone calling you got. Yeah.
Yeah, that was Clay calling us. Scam likely.
Yeah, he was calling you to let you know, I'm completely on your side.
Yeah, we might run into each other 2 years from now. So
yeah,
when you're... long con, short con.
Yeah, there you go. So yeah, this is just some backdoor dealings with Nerys Campbell, Clay, and Burrell. Although Clay is, like as we mentioned, kind of playing both sides, but pretty cynical strategy. You know, we've seen all throughout the show how detrimental juking the stats is to real police work. And this is kind of a last ditch effort by Burrell to stay in the city's good graces, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, from there, do you just want to talk about what's going on then on the ground level of policing?
Yes.
Since we're talking about juking stats, and that's where Mello is talking to his Western District shift and instructing them that, you know, we got to go after these quality of life arrests. And yeah. McNulty calls out, you know, it's the broken windows. I mean, Mello's still trying to pepper in, like, oh, there's real crime occurring, kind of showing the argument of Ed Burns and David Simon, like,
right.
You know, these break-ins and actual felony cases are what is getting swept under the rug, and an attempt to focus in on arresting a guy who's drinking some beer on the corner.
Yeah. Can you fill me in? What is the broken windows theory? Like, I have a vague idea, but, like... was Giuliani's.
Yeah, it's
thing.
Like, and Bill Bratton. So he was the, police chief who Ed Norris came up under. And it's just like, you know, if you have a block that has weeds growing and, you know, a decrepit looking vacant house, then it will attract crime and drug dealers and everything will snowball. So we got to nip it in the bud. Yeah. And then the other cops talking about how it worked in New York, and I think that's another one of David Simon's, like, big picture points where, you know, if you're an economic hub, you know, in the global economy, these type of policies will probably be effective, whereas, you know, someone says, like, we're not New York, we're Baltimore. Look at industry is dying around us at a rapid pace. Yeah, so, and I think it ties into, you know, a show that I'm grateful you... encouraged me to finish The Deuce, right? With all that Midtown Manhattan cleanup and development under Koch, the mayor. So we got some content coming on The Deuce maybe someday. Yeah. Does that make sense? Or?
No. Yeah. Thanks for, I kind of have like a general idea of what it was, but since you put it so eloquently, I'm glad we can put that whole thing to rest.
Yeah.
Maybe. Yeah, like every city needs a dozerman that'll pour malt liquor over somebody's shoes.
Yeah.
No, well, Caliccio.
Yeah, Caliccio.
I get these two mixed up.
What do you say, though? He's like, you got to, like, the Pilsner is now a Tailsner? Like,
he's like, you gotta shake hands with a Pilsner or a Pale Ale.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, Caliccio does look like a Pilsner guy. I used to drink IPAs. I feel bad now, like. That's what he's talking about, right?
Yeah.
Man. Anyways, yeah.
But yeah.
What a crime he committed there.
Yeah.
Wasting the man's brew.
But McNulty sees through like all this political bullshit, just decides to like actually do some real police work and notice a pattern of all the church burglaries and like actually goes after real criminals, showing that, like, hey, like, I can play this game too. If you want some more arrests, like, I can actually go after the substantive ones.
Yeah, they're going after some, sorry, I gotta get into some geo here.
Please.
Some Madison Park crimes. That's what Mello was talking about as far as the church burglaries. And then Baker says they caught the guy on coming out of St. Martin's on Fulton, couldn't find a record of any church like that, but there is a St. Martin on Madison in Madison Park. So I don't know what the hell's going on there. Also, yeah, I mean, that's a great point about McNulty still in the melee, like in the, just coming through with felony cases. Yeah. Like, wow, man, you need a key to a interrogation room? He's yeah. like, yeah, you know. Crazy stuff.
Pretty funny, like, or not funny. Well, kind of, like, it's dark humor. Like, in the midst of Coliccio and,
those
a
guys.
Bunch of them, like, doing these, like, petty arrests and, like, a riot is breaking out. He's just like, eh.
Yeah, yeah. Gonna, yeah, he's like,
we're going to, like, bypass all that. That's, like, not really concerning and, to us.
And he's like, oh, you know, it's, like, Baker's saying it's going to get out of control. And McNulty's like, that's the plan, right? More arrests for... You know, resisting the BS charges and this and that. What's also crazy about that scene, I know I'm a broken record here talking about broken windows. No, but the whole set designs and I get the filming location. They need to be economical, just like the last director for Know Your Place, Alex.
Zakrzewski.
Yeah, very like, you know, keeps it tight. But Cheetah's place, the bar where they're, you know, like doing the humbles, I think that's what it's called. Definitely on the east side, like most things that are filmed in these like seasons 3 and 4, and I don't know, we'll get to season 5 soon, but it's on Patterson and Eager, and I was trying to find it. I was trying to look up that bar and I wasn't figuring it out, so I found there's like a whatever, I use the auto body shop that still exists across the street to locate it. And now that place is like a it's like a, it has some school there with like a Hopkins in the name, and I've been you know, like Johns Hopkins is gentrifying all the east side, and it has like this really modern looking like office park or, and then on the Google street view there's just some white woman dressed in like a pizza outfit like a costume just waving at the camera, and I just found it ironic that, you know, this is, you know, the crux of the new policing tactics to juke the stats and quality of life and this and that, and that location is literally now a place that's been gentrified, and there's like, you know, to my knowledge, but I just, you know, you see a white woman wearing a pepperoni pizza outfit passing out flyers, then something's going on in that neighborhood, and Hopkins, you know, branding. So pretty bizarre, you know, 20 wonder, years later about, well, not that far, but
wonder if the, Google Earth cameraman approached her like, excuse me, is this, where, Coliccio poured out the malt liquor on said guy's shoes?
Yeah.
Oh man. Shout out to Ernest Dickerson, though, the episode's director. Pretty terrific stuff. He came up as being one of Spike Lee's go-to guys for cinematography.
Wait, hold it there. Was he the one that, now that you brought that up, was it him or Hemingway who got caught in like one of these type of sweeps when they were filming, or like, you know, with O'Malley in charge?
Ooh, I don't know. I don't remember.
Maybe it was. Just sorry, I should have looked this up.
Pretty decorated TV director, though. I think he's done episodes of Dexter, Tremé, all kinds of stuff.
I mean, maybe. Yeah. Thanks for that. Sorry, I'm like. Okay. Well, who? Yeah, maybe was Anthony Hemingway involved? Is he one of the guys? I just remember there was a young black director or member of the production who got swept up in one of these like ridiculous quality of life things where, you know, reminded me of what Mello's saying to Daniels. Was it Daniels? Where he's like, this is like, we're split half and half in our department. And Daniels saying, well, you know, like, what about the people in the neighborhood? They enjoy it. She's like, we are arresting the neighborhood. And I remember even J.D. Williams saying he got caught up in one of these type of things, like after bars closed. But maybe that was like specific to that district. But yeah, I mean, it's not like the wire cast and crew and production team was immune.
Right.
Not that they were, you know, the black members of the team. You know, I'm sure it happened to white white guys involved or white people involved too. Like no like amount of race goes into these policing decisions. It's all about class, right? But yeah, let's talk about like Daniels is doing some out of character stuff.
Yeah, he's taking you know pages from Perlman's playbook, where he's
Perlman's playbook. That's cool.
He is painting a stark contrast from season one Daniels, where he's just like, buy bus, street rips, chain of command. Now he's going outside of the chain of command to investigate whether or not Carcetti is in on this whole like harebrained scheme to juke the stats, because he knows like how detrimental that is to real police work. So yeah, this is just another example. Great writing, shows the incremental progressive politics that slowly make their way into Daniels's brain.
Right. Yeah. I mean, keep going.
But sorry. Like, so he goes to Carcetti's campaign office to like bring this up with him. He's like, I needed to test you to see if you were cool with this. And like, I'm not like, if you were, that'd be a problem with me. But he like doesn't realize that Carcetti is like, he's not aware of like, you know, the juking of the stats or like that Burrell's doing this, but he is like starting to play these like dicey political games that's gonna corrupt his political future. So maybe Daniels is speaking a little bit too soon, like we talked about in the last episode. Like him and Ronnie were like, oh, to Carcetti, he's gonna change the city around, but it's like, not so fast.
Right. Yeah, that was what I was going to ask you about. Carcetti is more involved in this than he's letting on. That's, you know, you just said, basically, right? Because I was like, oh, maybe not as linear as the whole O'Malley, like, Carcetti thing and the bone Simon had to pick with O'Malley.
But he's still, like, pissed off that Burrell is, like, going behind his back because he does want to get rid of him because he doesn't consider him an ally anymore. Isn't that correct?
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely. But yeah,
he's still like promoting Valchek and entertaining Clay Davis's schemes.
Not an intricate thing at all. Definitely, this is what we do for fun, and I don't have a headache thinking about all these schemes and stuff.
Yeah. While we're like on the policing stuff, do we want to talk a little bit about like Herc and Bubs? You know, such an odd couple.
Yeah. I guess all the times that Herc is literally in Bubbles' living room, just like hanging out. Like what? Like
showing up unannounced.
Yeah. Just super obvious too. And I mean, at least he's going to talk to him, even though he is, you know, at this point showing his true colors as a terrible cop and overall, person. But I mean, yeah, some pretty important things being discussed there, and Bubbles pushing back. Good for him.
Yeah. I mean, he's basically like getting to the root of like the whole argument I've been making throughout this whole project about like how unequal he's treated by the police. He's like, oh, well, the person who gets the camera gets $500 and a chicken box. Like, I get a chicken box.
Yeah, right.
Totally like exploiting his labor.
Brilliant stuff from Simon. I know I might have been harsh at the beginning of this recording, but you know, hey. He has to pull teeth to basically get the $40, you know, for giving them. He's giving them great information still.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not his fault that they're incompetent and can't, you know, turn little Kevin into an actual witness. So,
right.
But yeah, I mean, Herc's trying to put band-aids on this and that, buying him a phone, a burner. The end, it's not going to even matter because Herc can't actually even answer his phone because he's dealing with the consequences of his lies, basically.
Yeah, getting chewed out by Mary Mal. He can't even, like, he does like a, he tries to do like an apology and explain himself, but like, you know, Sidner told him, you know, you just got to be honest with him and get out ahead of it.
Yeah.
Bubs is calling him as he's getting robbed by the Terminator fellow.
Yeah. Crackhead Terminator.
Yeah. Doesn't answer the phone, which just further alienates Bubs from this whole thing. And finally, he decides to kind of like exact his revenge on him by making him seem like a fool, putting him on a wild goose chase, telling him Marlowe's bull are making a drop in a, you know, he basically sets a reverend up to get harassed by Herc and everything.
Yeah, pretty cold stuff from, I mean, Bubbles is, you know, like he has every right to do this. But
I mean, the poor reverend.
Though, yeah, like, that's what I'm saying. Like, is Bubbles also getting back at the church people who he's like, ah, these, like, they think they're so much better than me. Like, none of them will even talk to me. You know, I say good morning to the reverend. So he's like, ah, this is perfect storm. I'll just, you know, everybody can get it.
Create some more chaos.
What's up with his 3/6 mafia ringtone, though? Like, man, that's the most Herc thing, you know, just like, yeah, I got to stay fly while I violate your right. Sorry.
New to me. I'm not a huge 3/6 mafia fan. So unfortunately, I don't know.
Yeah. Not part of the golden era to you.
I mean, they won an Oscar, but.
Oh, yeah. Oh, it was related back to film. Then I'll give them some prestige award points.
Yeah, did you notice, like, sometimes Simon and company like to repeat lines or, like, themes or whatever? This is Eric Overmeyer helped write this episode. He's, like, the co-creator of Treme.
Yeah.
There's like this scene where Herc is, you know, frisking the reverend and he's like, be gentle, son. He's like, I'm not your fucking son.
Oh, yeah.
This was like, that's what Spider said to Cuddy at one point. And then in Treme, it was what the mugger said to Harley right before he shot him dead.
Yeah. So, spoiler alert.
Oh, come on.
Yeah. Like, we don't deal with spoy boys on this, on this project.
Yeah.
If you haven't seen the entire collection, then. Sorry.
I mean, it's not like, how can you spoil a show? Never mind.
Yeah, Willie hates boy boys. Like me. I'm always like, God, Willie. And I've seen the show twice already. And then he's like, wait, oh yeah, yeah, this scene. I'm like, dude, I'm too dumb to remember all these like moments. And then he just gets more frustrated with me. All right, so like we had talked about, the temperature in this room definitely increased, especially after that opening discussion about Officer Walker and David Simon and all that stuff. So, they're intentionally heating up classrooms to take advantage of kids. You know, they need them to be more drowsy and docile as the periods increase in length.
Yeah.
So they can really hammer home the important stuff, which is the testing.
Yeah. And Mr. Presbo is just getting more and more disillusioned with all of the shady tactics that the school district is using to, you know, juke the stats with the state assessment tests. And he's basically like putting on a show for the superintendent that he's really trying to stay to the curriculum. But of course, as soon as she leaves, he gets back into the fun stuff, talking about gambling, probabilities, how it relates to math, all that.
Yeah. And I just wanted to say that it's pretty sad that, you know, this whole like intentional heating thing occurred. I mean, I know it's winter in this episode, but I remember reading just as like schools opening this year. Literally, I think the first day of school, they had to send 35 schools, you know, students in 35 schools home in the Baltimore area because it was too hot, because they didn't have sufficient like cooling.
Jesus.
So, I mean, I think it was a combination. I think it was like 30 schools in Baltimore City, and to be exact. But I mean, that's, I think there's like 160 to 180 schools. So it's not like the majority, but man, still messed up.
Yeah.
But yes.
Pretty.
Colvin's doing like whatever your kid loves, and it's a fun teacher though, right? It's like, oh, we're going to, you know, we're going to play it this way for these people. Okay. Yeah. Like this reminds me, I mean, obviously we're so far removed from this type of environment, but we went to kind of like a renegade elementary school and it was like, all right, when like we're getting a site visit, you know, this is how we're going to act. And then, you know, as soon as they leave, it's like, all right, recess or like fun, interactive, hands-on games or whatever we were doing. So,
I mean, it's also kind of like in high school when we were all like collectively holding our breath because the WASC committee
would always
come to visit, and it was like, oh, they came to visit while there was a stabbing on campus.
Yeah, I was going to mention this. Okay, I'm glad you like, I don't think it was actual stabbing, right? I just heard that some girl had like a kitchen knife in her bag or something.
Oh, okay. There, thanks for...
But I'm glad you took it to like a Savage Willie take. Like, no. Like some kid just got slaughtered and butchered in front of the WASC commission, and then we all got sent to San Quentin.
No, I'm glad you brought it back down to earth and, you know,
this is how,
fought
like,
against my...
Hey, it's
in
been...
Unintentional editorializing or like...
Yeah, but I mean, what? I mean, it's been almost like a decade and a half since you were there. So, I mean, this is how, like, you know, as we get older, like telephone games related to our youth, you know, where it's like, wow, remember, like, yeah, that crazy time, like, blah, blah, blah. Oh, did it happen like that? It's like, we're old. We're underperforming. We're bored. Let's make up something exciting that happened in the past. Sorry.
Time is a flat donut.
Yeah, time is a flat donut. But yeah, I guess, you know, we have such a bizarre upbringing in some ways that we can come up with stories. Like, our relatability is so, like, you know, vast, where it's like, oh, you know, this weird startup, like, Amish-type school. And then it's like, oh, we actually kind of had, like, some very urban educational experiences.
Right.
Where it's like, oh, hold our breath. Like, are we going to get taken over by the state? Okay, maybe, maybe not. Probably doesn't look good. Yeah, kids with knives.
Yeah.
But yeah, kind of leading into the big situation when you're at, like, Superintendent Jefferson or what? I don't know. We try to get, like, every character's name, nail it, but I can't remember.
Oh.
But she's really.
Yeah, she's pretty, like, traditional, like, saying, like, oh, the special corner kids class is not education as I see it. Like, it's not in my interpretation. Like, you're trying to socialize them, but Zenobia, or wait, did Chandra slap Zenobia?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then she just like pushes Chandra, I forgot this game, Miss Schmoke, we'll call her. She pushes her on the ground.
Yeah.
And they're like, all right, time to get the cops. I mean.
Yeah. But this is not a good day.
No.
Earlier on that, like, Darnell was completely at a loss of, like, what to do in a situation when they're at a restaurant, somebody brings somebody a menu, and, like, they have to order. Like, pretty, like, you know, real life situation stuff that isn't taught in a lot of schools. And it's, you know, they're all worthwhile lessons. I mean, like, there is something to be said that, like, there's these arguments now, about the failings of, like, the public school system. Like, yeah, like, they don't teach kids, like, how to balance a checkbook or, like, do their own taxes. Like, no real life skills. A lot of real life skills aren't taught in, you know, normal education.
I mean, that, I like that argument where it's like, oh, you know, kids need to learn about, you know, what a mortgage payment is and like property tax and stuff. But then, I mean, this is probably maybe also problematic, but, you know, of course, from the standpoint of the scene, not for my upcoming analysis here, but I mean, Zenobia and Chandra are at a like welfare office, basically. She's talking about the DSS card.
Yeah.
So it's like, is that just like, that is their floor for just social interaction? Like, well, you know, I mean, is this, I guess what I'm trying to get to is this, you know, once you get out of, you know, middle school, you'll enter high school and then you'll be on welfare as an adult. Or is it like they're teaching them how to deal with it as kids because they need to advocate for themselves, kind of like how Mike has to be in charge of the DSS card because they have parents who are unable to handle the stuff going on with the department, like of welfare or the social services.
All of the above.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm like, you know, is this the best scenario? I mean, I guess Colvin's whole thing is like, we can't lie to these kids. Right. We got to keep it truthful. So even if the superintendent's here, we're still going to like be like, you know, look, our education system is probably going to fail these kids and they're going to end up on welfare just like, you know, kids wound up on the corner just like their parents were.
Yeah. I mean, and he's definitely better at putting that delicately than Parenti is.
Yeah, what?
he's so aggro.
Yeah. I was going to mention that. What is going on with him? He's really helping his beloved study in this day. He's like, no, listen.
Fuck you.
Yeah, listen, black woman. Like, I'm going to yell at you. It's like, dude, what are you, like, how, yeah. Look how you're talking to her. Like, yeah. Dude, what is wrong with him? Yeah. It's not about race. It's about class. They're in the same class, right? Both academia.
Right.
But,
have we wrapped the education section up, you think? Anything?
Yeah, I think we did in like a roundabout way. It's fun.
Yeah. So some pretty, you know, ahead of the time stuff where Poot is like super woke about climate change.
Yeah, man.
Talking about global warming and stuff.
This man does not lie about his trade days. Like he is, Trey Cheney is, he knows what's up, man. Okay. That's...
Yeah. One of my favorite Twitter follows for sure. Just like always injecting, like yeah. There's so much negativity on the Twitterverse and Trey Cheney just comes along. He's like, thank God every day, like spread positivity and love, like always, like count your blessings. Great guy.
Check out my new music video coming out.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah. I want to tell you, Willie, I'm around too many true millionaires. So success is the only option for me.
There you go.
Yeah.
But,
yeah, man. Great stuff, though. And then Bodhi's talking about places that are really, you know, being impacted by climate change, like Florida, the Bahamas, you know, hurricane after hurricane, superstorms, destruction. Man, brilliant stuff.
Yeah. But it is, you know, even though the world might be getting warmer, there's still people are getting colder and killing people indiscriminately. You know, tying up all loose ends that may not even have to be tied up. Bodhi's getting kind of like a taste of his own medicine here, where he feels really guilty about telling Kevin to get out ahead of this whole Randy police debacle and try to like calm Marlo down about him potentially being implicated as a snitch, and he ends up getting killed, and Slim Charles breaks the news to him in like the most casual.
Yeah.
Shit. Damn, is like, dude. So awkwardly funny, where Slim Charles just like rolls up and he's like, hey man, I'm sorry that your friend got killed. And then he like
just rolls like, the window
up. Yeah, he rolls the window up on him and drives away like in such a like casual offhanded way. I mean, like Slim Charles is a team player no matter what. Like he's one of the only characters that like makes it all the way through all these different, you know, changes of the power structure and whatnot. So he's just like, hey man, like can't get too sympathetic to Bodhi in this moment. I gotta let him know that I care, but at the end of the day, like I'm still working for Prop Joe and he's in bed with Marlo, so I gotta
he's a great character. One of the most underrated. Dude, I held on to that. I'm like, dude, I know where Roland Presbyluski's name came from. It's from Hometown Boy.
It's from the story about the failed pharmaceutical company that didn't have to just cave into the growing crime and drug trade in their Patterson Park neighborhood, but the Slumlord Rite Aid Corporation that came in and started buying out mom and pop stuff. I'm going to post this. Jim Troop Frost. He's trending. He just debuted in a show called American Rust on Showtime. It's going to be great. Everyone's going to like it.
Not a single one, man. But yeah, I was going to mention that. It's so crazy. There's this Showtime show, I just mentioned, American Rust with Jeff Daniels. I don't know if you've seen flyers or... Yeah, so it's just like small town, slice of life, Americana, like Rust Belt, Pennsylvania, southwestern Pennsylvania, you know, murder mystery or not type show. And literally in the first episode, there's a scene where one of the main characters gets, you know, jumped, or he gets in a fight and then he ends up, you know, getting arrested for it. And the first cop on the scene is like an off-duty, drunk, incompetent police officer waving his gun around. And it's none other than Jim True Frost doing his best prez. Like he's riding that, like,
hey man.
Yeah, he's riding, got it.
He's cashing those checks from getting typecasted.
Yeah, so exactly. But yeah, sorry for that rant. But no, I just had to get off my chest.
It's adding, you know, we're adding flavor.
Yeah, but tell us about some of this brilliant set design.
Oh yeah, so it's like you know, in my mind, after like Bodhi gets the news and he's very distraught, standing like by himself on the street corner as Slim Charles cold-bloodedly just drives away. there's still like campaign signs in the background for Royce and Nerys Campbell, like weeks after the election has already been held. Just some brilliant set design there, showing that like these are desolate parts of the city that the city politic, the city political elite has kind of forgotten about and it's not even paying attention to now that the election is over. Like, oh, we don't even need to go over there and, you know, start campaigning on change and stuff because the election's over. There's still campaign signs up, whatever. Like, that's fine. It just speaks to the whole dysfunction of everything that they're forgotten people.
Great point. Yeah. So we were talking a little about Slim Charles and, you know, how he's able to navigate. And there's, you know, someone who's kind of keeping tabs on him, right? Inadvertently crosses his eye, you know, that being Omar and Naldo in their surveillance.
Right.
Vacant. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's kind of confusing, but
Omar is like kind of confused as to why Slim Charles, who's like a known Barksdale soldier, is now like surviving through like all the power struggles and stuff. He's eating cotties from Fadley's.
God damn it. Yeah, man. Really, I still want those.
Really good.
Are they flying? Are you flying me in some? Willie has offered me some prior to me. He took advantage of my lack of, you know, spoiler knowledge to make a joke that he's going to give me some cotties if I help him out with a little side project. And I was like, no, I'm not eating out this month. I'm trying to be really disciplined. I'm also gluten intolerant, blah, 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 blah. It's such, man, so dumb.
Yeah.
Good one. That was a good one.
It's like a fried mashed potato ball with traces of salted codfish. And Naldo, I guess he's not into it as much as Omar is.
Naldo's like, no. Dude, I'm Puerto Rican. I mean, it's like a cross-cultural. I mean, he's obviously from out of town, right? And he's like maybe representing the new wave of like Highland Town Latino immigrant populations. I don't know. Maybe we would have learned more if there was a season 6.
But I like it just how just like Omar is like, they're from Fadley's though. Yeah. Like, how do you, yeah, it's a staple.
Yeah. How do you not know? I wonder. It's pretty funny stuff. But Omar has no regrets also about jacking Marlowe's ring, and he would have
enjoyed it more if he knew who he was.
Interesting. Yeah. But yeah, that kind of was a succinct storyline. What's our last action item here? Naaman.
Yeah. He gets arrested for slinging on the corner by Carver, but Carver kind of gives him the benefit of the doubt, and he probably picks up on that he's not raised in the best household. Like, he locked his dad up and probably gets that his mom is pretty neglectful, just going off on random trips to Atlantic City and New York to watch Broadway shows.
Yeah. I mean, she had no money. It was drying up. Yeah. She's still on these extravagant, I don't know, people would call AC extravagant these days, but never been. So, I've heard. But I've heard also some decent things, but I don't know.
He lets him spend the night at the station, and then cuts a deal with him that Bunny Colvin will take him in for the night. And it's kind of further cementing our views that Naaman is, a real softy at heart, because he's very polite in the household, and, telling Bunny's wife how delicious the meal is and is eating the cobbler with a la mode with glee.
Jesus. Supper is finished, honey. I am in a Norman Rockwell painting. So he figures out the whole Bunny nickname, and I don't know. I think that it's pretty brilliant on his behalf, because he kind of lulled Lolita, Bunny's wife, into this false sense of I'm such a nice kid. I'm not from the streets. You were talking about his manners. So she lets her guard down. It's Bunny here. So I think this is just some really good stuff from Naaman to get that bit of information, but he'll never be able to use it because
he's going to get his balls cut off.
Yeah. Which is apparently a cop thing. I mean, they wanted to do that to Bodhi a long time ago, Hurricane Carver, but I don't think Bunny's going to display them at the FOP lodge. This is more some Zero Dark 30 type stuff. They'll disappear, you know? But what's up with the nickname? I mean, I know this was kind of the conversation being had in some of our social media circles. Where did he get his nickname? Yeah, we couldn't. I don't know.
Yeah. Who knows?
As a literal podcast, we're there's a real person named Bunny Cole. It's just one shout out, though.
Yeah.
I feel bad if I led people to believe that this is something that was major news and everyone was aware of. It's really just one line, one name in an article, 50 others. But who knows?
It kind of fits in with the whole Simon thing. He's your grandma was named McNulty? Yeah. Or your family name was McNulty on your mom's side or something? Let's have the main character's name instead. Yeah, sure, why not?
We'll let it roll. But I don't know. I mean,
it's kind of, it paints a nice picture what you're talking about, how Robert Wisdom was I don't want to portray this guy as a do-gooder.
Oh,
he is. He's I'm going to cut your balls off. Kind of nice contrast to all the moral high ground stuff he's exhibiting on earlier in this episode, in the last episode.
I'm still tough, man. Don't test me. Yeah.
But can we maybe we talked a little bit about last episode, how Mike's stepdad is maybe the worst parent. I mean, probably still is, but again, Delanda shows up here and just exhibits how awful she is, that she's disappointed in her son because he's not quote unquote hard enough to go to baby booking.
Yeah, baby booking, man. That's Naaman should be able to handle no problem.
She wants him to follow in his father's footsteps to a T.
And he's thinking damn, dude, the stories I've heard about that place, I don't want to have to go through any of that if that's what it means, being hard.
Yeah.
So, we're doing pretty good here.
Yeah, she's I want you to end up in jail. I want you to be in jail with your father.
Yeah. Yeah, what? Damn, dude, what happened to her when she was a kid?
I don't know. Super, apparently, super nice lady in real life. All the writers talk very highly of her. She's done a lot of great social work. Sandy McCree.
Yeah, yeah.
Terrific acting.
Cleveland.
Based on, like, you know, what we've heard about you. You play such a horrible mother, but apparently you've done great stuff.
Oh, yeah, yeah, definitely.
But yeah, Mike's stepdad is pretty awful and he deserves to get beat to death by Chris. No.
Yeah, Mike's stepdad is terrible. And yeah, I mean, like we've talked about in our even last episode, like, you know, no one's necessarily advocating for murder, but this guy, you know, like I guess I can say like I probably feel worse for Old Face Andre negotiating his, you know, tomb or wherever, you know, his cemetery position. But yeah, I don't know. It's still, I mean, it's hard to watch, obviously. It's so brutal, but pretty crazy stuff with like the design of this scene. Remember from, was that All the Pieces Matter? About like what they had to do to make this look as realistic as it was.
Yeah. And it's a stark contrast. I mean, all the stuff that we think about Mike's stepdad is never like explicitly stated. It's more in like what's not talked about. And like the, we talked about the 1,000-yard stares that Michael and Chris have, like when even like broaching this subject, kind of like intimating that Chris probably dealt with similar trauma in his life, and this is why he's so like amped up about carrying this task out, as opposed to like all the other bodies they dispose of in the vacants with such like cold, calculated professionalism. This is where he like really lets loose and kind of like tortures this guy to death.
I think
they had to do some real crazy like prosthetic special effects work to make this seem as
real or prosthetic.
It's pretty brutal the way like it's great that they show how like violent and awful and gory this is, because it drives home the message of this is some much needed violence, because it needs to show you know, Chris's connection to this this subject.
Yeah.
Snoop is even horrified by
it. Yeah. Yeah. And offers some comedic timing.
Yeah.
Like, didn't even wait to walk him into the house. Yeah. And
insanely humorous comment she gives there.
Yeah. A natural. I hope Felicia Snoop Pearson's doing okay with the loss of her good friend. Yeah. Sad.
Pretty heartbreaking.
But yeah, her question, you know, about why Mike wants, you know, stepdad off, it's pretty classic too. Like the most Baltimore, you know, accent. For those who say it's not authentic enough, have they not watched Misgivings?
Yeah.
Due to you. I don't want to even try to, you know.
Yeah.
Reenact it.
A lot of people talk about how Jay Landsman and Tootsie Duvall have the most authentic Baltimore accents on the show. Like, hello, Felicia Pearson, yeah. Robert Chu. Like,
yeah. What the? Spider? No. Like any of the like local casting of youth, and you know, probably what's his name? Brandon Price, Stinkum.
Right. I mean, Michael K. Williams. Yeah. Like, New York resident, but did a lot of like pretty method acting stuff to get the, I mean, it's pretty close. Like,
yeah, he gets it. Great stuff.
Is there anything else that we?
No, I don't think so.
Thank you to everybody who's listened to us. We had a great time entertaining you all. As always, we said it at the top. If you want to donate to us, you can do so at anchor.fm/thegodswillnotsaveyou/support. And as a reminder, that money will be going to Michael K. Williams's nonprofit, Making Kids Win.
Thank you. Yeah. And appreciate all of our listeners, anyone who wishes to support. Big thank you. And also want to say thanks to some of our creative support, like Mostart, who has lended some of his original work to our project with the bumpers, intro, outro. So check him out, mostart.com. You know, follow him on social, Mostart.
Yeah.
Always posting some interesting stuff. Great artist.
Yeah. Also great art work from Andre Tesnes, who's the graphic designer who did our podcast logo.
Yeah. Awesome. Very legit. Can't thank him enough.
Yeah.
Timeless.
Check us out on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Where the gods will not save you on all platforms.
Yeah. Also, thegodswillnotsaveyou@gmail.com if you wish to connect with us via email.
All right. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks.
Talk to you next time.
See ya.